You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, April 2nd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA, on today's program, Barney Frank's bombshell. Well, maybe a bit of an exaggeration, but made to get a point. David Dayen will join us to talk about it. Then we'll head into some of our clown car updates. Meanwhile, Indiana, with its RFRA fix, they still can discriminate against gay people, transgender people. Hoosiers are so loving. It's hard to believe they would do that. Also, Robert Menendez, the indictments have come down, and they are serious. If trade sports still existed, maybe it does, but I don't think we can access it. I would say bet on Robert Menendez ending up in prison. But we will discuss. He's outraged, incidentally, at the accusations, or the charges, I should say. The indictments. Outraged. Meanwhile, Chris Rock has been documenting how many times he gets stopped by the police when he's driving around L.A. Also, a fast food strike just 2 weeks away. Looks like it could be a big one. And the Durbin-Schumer rift out in the open now. One questions what it's going to mean for Durbin. Schumer still seems to be the lock on the Senate majority leadership. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I should say, today is going to be the last live day that I will be on for over a week and a day. Matt and Mike will do the better half tomorrow live. And we have almost 5 days, I guess 4 days of new programming next week. I'm going to pre-tape with Cliff later today. And we're going to have 4 new days worth of interviews for next week. And members, we're going to pull some archive stuff for you. So you guys probably won't even realize I'm on vacation. Those who listen live will, but the vast majority of you listen via podcast. So a little bit of house cleaning to do. First off, I've been getting a lot of emails asking me about stretch goals on the Indiegogo campaign, and I'm still trying to figure out exactly what that means in the context of the Indiegogo campaign, but I wanted to read one email. Francisco writes, I just donated 50 guys to you through Indiegogo. I listen to your podcast every day. In fact, you're the only podcast I never miss. So in the name of a shameless pat on the back, can I get a shofar? You can, and share this, please, with everyone. I wish I wasn't sick this week, because I'd be able to express far more. You'd hear more excitement in my voice, but as it is, I can barely.
Support.
I can be. Thanks very much. it really has been incredibly gratifying, and still determined to put up the last two perks that we had in reserve. If people want them, they want them. Don Quixote, well, you'll see what they are, and I will do that over the weekend. and just a couple other reminders. One is Just Coffee, this entire month, is doing free shipping. So if you've ever thought that you wanted to try Just Coffee, now is the time to do it. JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And get the Majority Report blend. Free shipping. Apparently, I'm not quite sure how they're doing this, but you could order literally 100 pounds of coffee and get free shipping off it. And their coffees by the pound are, in some cases, less, some cases more. I mean, it's all fair trade. Then you'll see it like Starbucks or at your local coffee shop. So if you buy coffee, particularly buy the bean, now's the time to try it because it's free shipping. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk to David Dayan. We have a clip of an interview I did with Barney Frank. This is important stuff, both to get to understand what was missed in the past and so that somehow the record can be made clear going forward in the future. Before we go there, we've got to tell you today the show is being sponsored by Harry's. I've mentioned Harry's before. I don't like to shave, so I don't buy that many razors in general. Harry's is the first triple razor I ever used. And it makes for a great gift, but it's also, it saves a tremendous amount of money. It's a great razor. They're now saying that if you're a first-time buyer, you get $5 off using the coupon code Majority Report. Their starter kit is just $15. So in that that starter kit, you get three blades. It comes obviously with a razor, and it's a nice looking razor. And you get your choice of like a shaving cream or the gel. I've talked to you about this in the past. I'm a gel guy. So you get $5 off. That's $10 for three razors and shaving cream. You cannot beat that. And their shipping is also free. So that's it. It's $10 for a razor when you use the coupon code MAJORITYREPORT at harrys.com. They make great razors. And it's one of the partners, the same guy from Warby Parker. And so they do that same thing where they give 1% of their sales and 1% of their time to organizations that help people. They've completed a 1,000-hour challenge. The company as a whole volunteered 1,000 hours worth of skills. So check it out, harrys.com. Use the coupon code MAJORITYREPORT if it's your first time there, and you will get three razors, shaving cream, and three blades, shaving cream, and a razor for $10. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with David Dayan. I could sleep.
when I lived alone, is there a ghost in my house? When I lived alone, is there a ghost in my house? My
We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone, always a pleasure to welcome one of my favorite writers in the entire world. In the entire world. Not just in the Western Hemisphere, but the entire world, ladies and gentlemen. David Dayan. David, welcome back to the program.
I think you're shortchanging writers from far-flung places like New Zealand, or maybe Indochina. They deserve a shot.
Well, that's why I say one of, because there's a couple over there that I do
right.
also appreciate. But
absolutely.
But you and I mean, I know, you know, you and I share the same frustration about this story. And it is you pointed out that it's one of the few sort of anecdotes or comments or it's one of the few things that's actually been pulled from Barney Frank's book, and it is incredibly important. Just tell us what it is as a tee up, because I asked this question, and I probably asked this question to Barney Frank, to be honest with you, because I saw you writing about the interview that he gave in the New Yorker magazine. I don't know that for a fact, but I imagine that's the case because you've been
right.
on this.
I wrote about it at the time. Matt Stoller wrote about it at the time. 2.5 years ago, he told this little anecdote to New York magazine, and he includes it in his book and expands on it a little bit in his book. And the anecdote is this, that at the way that TARP works, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, was there was language in it that said, in addition to giving all this money to the banks to nurse them back to health, you need to use TARP funds to prevent foreclosures. That was in the statute. And the TARP money came out in two tranches. It was $350 billion each time. And the first tranche, the Bush administration simply did not use any of that money for foreclosure relief, as they were directed to in the statute. So Barney Frank got pretty angry about this, and he held a hearing and berated Henry Paulson for, you know, going against the wishes of Congress. And just to back up, the TARP would not have passed without that language. TARP failed the first time it came up for a vote, and the way in which they got Democrats back on board enough to pass the statute, remember Democrats controlled Congress at the time, was that they promised this foreclosure relief.
What does that mean, foreclosure relief? I mean, like an explicit term.
What it meant is that a chunk of the TARP money was going to go to help people save their homes. There wasn't language specifically on what it would do in the statute. It gave discretion to the executive branch, but it said money is going to help people save their homes, money from TARP that we're authorizing right here. Now you figure it out how to do it.
And so that could have been like a I mean, during the Great Depression, you could be actually buying up people's mortgages.
And then selling them back to them. It could have been direct debt relief, like a check. It could have been anything. There was no limit on what it could have been. And the second part of this that Barney pointed out was that these banks are dependent on government support at the moment and would be susceptible to persuasion to reduce debt on their mortgage borrowers or have the money cut off. So that was the idea. And Barney continued to push on this. And he talked to Paulson, and Paulson finally said, "All right, we."
Well,
need
wait a second.
To
let's what? Hear. Well, let's. I think let's. Okay. Now that we've set that table, here's where I start to ask Barney Frank that question. I think it was at Netroots Nation 2013. Okay. Here's that audio now.
One of the things that I read in interviews, at least one interview that you gave. Upon your retirement from the House, regarding TARP, and I imagine you know these are bygone conversations, but very important stuff. One of the things that you had talked about in this New York Magazine interview was in the second go around with TARP that you had had conversations with Henry Paulson regarding providing mortgage relief directly to mortgage holders. And Henry Paulson said, if you can get me the second chunk of TARP money, then I'm willing to do that if the incoming Obama people sign off on it. And you said that they wouldn't do it.
Yeah, it's a problem with the interregnum. People who are historians will remember this is a terrible problem between Franklin Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover. And in fact, we amended the Constitution, not me, older people. The new president used to take office March 4th. They moved it back to January 20th, but we still had too much of an interregnum. Yeah, I asked the Obama people to do it, and it now turns out Nancy Pelosi wasn't sure we could have gotten it through, but what we needed, if Paulson requested it, the way it worked is that money would be spent unless Congress voted to cancel it, but the president could have vetoed that, so it would have worked. But he said, I'm not going to do that. It's now like December. Without Obama saying it's okay. And I asked the Obama administration, the incoming, and they said, well, we're not in power. He can do it if he wants to. It's what Roosevelt said to Hoover. If you want to do it, you do it. I'm not going to take responsibility until I'm in charge. And I understood in part what they were saying. We don't want to be held accountable because we're not administering. But I was frustrated with both of them. And in fact, Obama said at that point, well, we only have one president at a time. And my response was that that overstated the number of presidents we then had. And, that was a lost opportunity. I was very frustrated.
So do you attribute that to a process? I mean, was it just simply a notion of process, or was it just simply not their policy?
No, I don't think it was not their policy, in fairness. Paulson was somewhat reluctant, but basically what happened was this. When we were voting on the TARP, Paulson said, can I have the money? And I think highly of Paulson. We've worked together. But he was thinking only of what was needed to keep the financial community from falling apart. We said you need two things. You need some limitations on compensation, and you need to do something about mortgage relief. He was reluctant, but we said, no bill if you don't do that. We're writing the bill. So we wrote into the bill the requirement of mortgage relief. And the New York Times had an editorial quoting me. I waved at him the bill, literally, the angriest confrontation I had with him when he said, I don't have the authority. Showed him he did. So he was reluctant, but finally I was able to say to him, you promised me, and we put it in the bill, and you owe this to those who voted for it. On the Obama side, they basically felt, and it wasn't just on this one, and it's what every incoming president says, don't tie my hands. You know, and they both had an argument. Paulson said, I don't want to take this responsibility and lock in the Obama people. Obama said, I'm not in charge. I don't want to be held accountable for spending money when I have no control. So I think it was risk aversion on both sides.
He was perfectly willing to tie the hands in regards to bailing out the banks.
Well, no, Obama supported that. He was, on the first chunk, it was on the second chunk that, he was reluctant to use the authority. Well, I take it back. His view was it was important to keep the economy from melting down totally, to get the money out right away. That's why he wanted the first amount without that. When we saw that he was doing that without it, we yelled and screamed, and then we got him to commit to doing it with the second amount, and Obama said, I'm not going to get involved before I'm involved. And Obama's position was, if Paulson wants to do that, he can do it. He has the authority, or Bush, rather.
Right, and Bush was
in Texas. Was
right.
I mean, we had a meeting in September or October, which McCain forced, and Bush was presiding, Cheney, and Democratic and Republican leadership of the House and the Senate, the Finance Service Committee, and Bush was sitting there, and somebody said to somebody else, "We got to look at him. He's in Texas already." He was like staring at the ceiling.
Well, he's probably contemplating some of his artwork that he was going to be doing.
He did say at one point when McCain was showing a really irresponsible, he forced the meeting. He wouldn't say what he thought. I am told that Bush said to Nancy Pelosi, "I told you you were going to miss me," with regard to McCain.
So, I mean, is there not? Let me. I mean, just I don't want to. You know, I don't want to beat a dead horse here. But is there not some measure of inconsistency with President Obama being supportive of the first chunk when he's not president, but not being willing to sort of endorse the spending of the authorized second chunk?
Well, don't you act like I'm supposed to defend this. I'm the one who brought it out. I'm the one who was criticizing him. Of course, I'm the one who said we have no president. Yes, I critical of both of them.
Fair enough.
But I would have thought that was clear. And when I say you've overstated the number of presidents we have, that's hardly an endorsement of the way they were behaving.
Right.
To say that they're both advocating responsibility.
So there you have it, David. And obviously, Barney Frank was getting a little testy towards the end as he
texted. Well, as it's not a Barney Frank interview if he doesn't get testy at some point.
Indeed. But, I mean, that is really the – I mean, that is the part that doesn't quite jibe. And you make that point that the Obama administration, President Obama, certainly had no troubles pushing other elements of TARP.
Yeah, you really hit a key issue, and you didn't even have all the ammunition, because what we learned when David Axelrod did his tell-all this year is that the Obama administration, while during the transition, before he was president, pushed the Bush administration to use parts of TARP to lend to the auto companies for a few months until they got into office. They had no problem using their pull prior to being president to tie their own hands to keep auto companies afloat. They had no problem with that. Homeowners, they had a problem with. That they didn't want to take the responsibility. So there's a clear double standard here.
And let's be clear, too, that when you commit to keeping the car companies out of bankruptcy in that way, when you commit to the car company rescue, which I happen to have also favored, that is, your hands are far more tied. You have a lot less sort of wiggle room there than you would in the context of we're going to help foreclosure people.
Right.
Who are,
and what's the difference here? The difference is that keeping the car companies afloat didn't have much to do with the balance sheets of the banks, and keeping homeowners afloat did, because the losses that it didn't have to. There were ways that you could have done it without the losses being reflected on the bank's balance sheets, but the way in which people thought about it was, if you let people stay in these homes, if you cut their principal balance, then banks would have to reflect those losses on their balance sheets, and they would show that they are actually technically insolvent at this time, and it would be such a disaster, yada, yada, yada. So that's what the difference is that they were willing to go the extra mile before becoming president, breaking that sacred principle of only one president at a time. They were willing to do that in all sorts of ways, but they weren't willing to do it if it meant that banks had to reflect losses from a crisis that they caused. The crisis they caused was the massive foreclosure crisis, which was brought on by a host of illegalities in the origination and securitization process.
All right. Explain to people, just lastly, why it's so important to get this into. I mean, it's obviously in the record, but it's obviously something that has been really almost actively ignored by the mainstream media, right? I mean, this is a
ignored. It has been completely ignored. And you know, I mean, I was talking to someone yesterday, and they said, you know, the way you really hide juicy information, critical information, is to put it in a book. So, you know, sometimes this stuff can get sort of buried, but this is critical. I mean, there are academic studies that show that the failure to arrest the damage from the foreclosure crisis is the primary cause of our sluggish recovery that lasted 6 years. That the failure to get people, you know, out of this crushing debt and relieve their situations is what tamped down consumer spending for all this time and put a lead weight on the economy. So this was a moment where the Obama administration could have set themselves up for a much stronger economy and help millions of people with a handshake. This was not something that had to go through Congress. The previous administration was committed to it. We don't know what they would have done, but certainly they only had a few weeks in office at that point, and it could have been something built upon by the incoming administration. And they decided not to do it. And this was the point of highest leverage. The second tranche of TARP money hadn't gone out. Banks were still technically insolvent and at least reliant on government support. That was the moment when you say to them, all right, we're going to give you this money, but here's what you're going to do for it. But they chose not to do that. Instead, they gave all the money, nursed everybody back to health, and then said, could you help these homeowners who are being thrown out of their homes? And they were given the answer no, basically.
Well, yeah.
The HAMP program that was put in was entirely discretionary on the part of mortgage servicers, and they not only ignored it, but they used it actively as a predatory lending program by manipulating the terms of it to push people further and further into debt and denying them loan modifications and forcing them out of their homes. So this was a terrible decision that was only compounded by the decisions made after the TARP money all got out.
So there's two things that occur to me. One is that the idea that, I mean, look, the idea that it just worked out this way, that, I mean, it's clear that President Obama, it wasn't just a question of like, I don't really have the authority for this. I mean, it's clear that this is the policy, right? I mean, the old game that Paulson's playing here, like, you got to ask the president-elect, and the president-elect says, like, I'm not really the president, so I can't, you know, it's like calling some type of, I don't know, calling your, checking on your phone bill, and they go, well, I'm not authorized to do this. You need to check with my supervisor. All right, let me talk to your supervisor. Supervisor's not here. You know, it's basically that scam.
Right. It was that kind of a game. It was a catch-22. It was a way to avoid responsibility for this massive crisis.
Right. How do we put off Barney?
System, hundreds of billions of dollars of losses were in the system, and nobody wanted the banks to take any of them. And so if they denied responsibility for it long enough, they could ensure that the banks didn't have to take those losses.
And so people have to understand that not only was a conscious decision made to not rectify the situation on behalf of the banks, the situation that the banks are responsible for, but in service to the banks, we're not going to rectify the situation, and we're going to cause considerable amount of increased pain over the course of the next six, seven, and frankly, like you make a point, we still have a million foreclosures in the pipeline. Maybe it's another couple of 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
We're probably in the seventh or eighth inning of the foreclosure crisis. Most of the loans that are delinquent right now date back to that period. The only reason they're not foreclosed upon is a combination of factors, one being banks lost the paperwork and don't actually know who owns what. And so there has been elongated foreclosure processes in many of the states that require a court order. But these are all legacy loans. These are all legacy problems that we're still dealing with. And we're still dealing with it because of that original sin, that when the banks were at their moment where they had the least leverage and they were most willing and sort of resigned to accepting terms, they wouldn't do it. I mean, banks were preparing in meetings to deal with a world where they had to prepare for bankruptcy judges to be able to modify the terms of primary mortgages in bankruptcy. They thought that was going to happen because the Obama administration was preaching that on the campaign trail, and it's one of the things that in this handshake agreement, basically, Hank Paulson could have said, look, we're going to modify these terms unless you start doing something about it. He could have scared the life out of the banks. And they thought it was going to happen, and it didn't happen because the Obama administration pissed away the leverage that they had and tried to put these things together when they couldn't happen. And that was a very deliberate choice that they tried to pass bills when there was no leverage to pass the bill, or they tried to put together something that was discretionary when there was no leverage to force the people at whose discretion it was to actually, relieve homeowners. So that was the deal.
All right. Well, David, thanks so much for staying on this because, I mean, it's obviously very important. I mean, particularly, you know, Chuck Schumer more than likely going to be the next Democratic majority or minority leader, depending on what happens in 2016 in the Senate. And this is a guy who couldn't be closer to the banks and very problematic. So, I mean, something obviously people should be aware of. David Dayan, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks. Got a couple. Excuse me. Couldn't get to the cough button quick enough on that one. I mean, just very important stuff, and someday we'll have a transcription service, and so when we have an interview like that in real time, we'll be able to put it out there and somebody will write a story around it. But maybe that we'll save that for Myla's tenure here at the Majority Report. I want to just talk about the Indiana supposed fix, and then we'll go into the fun half, and we're going to do a little bit of an update on the clown car. Was planning on doing a far more extensive one. I have a feeling they're all going to be here when we get back, and maybe Cliff and I will talk about some of the reasons why that will be the case. Super PACs are really going to be problematic for they're going to be helpful on one level to the establishment of the Republican Party, but they're also going to be very problematic because there's no reason anymore for people to drop out of a race ever. You know, we saw this with guys like Gingrich and Santorum. It's a tour of the country. And they sell a book and they build an email list. I mean, for all the reasons why I would run for president, they would do so too, but they would actually have the financing, which is I would run for president, I'd go around, and maybe I'd do a couple of speaking engagements, and I'd write a funny book, and who knows? Maybe 2024, folks. but first to Indiana. They're very excited about the fix in Indiana. Should we play the pizza thing? We'll save that for the other half. I mean, I actually feel sort of sad for those pizza people on some level because I think they're as much naive as they are ignorant. And they didn't necessarily mean to sort of communicate this to the world, but I mean, I sort of blame, with all due respect, Jesus, for forcing them to.
sometimes that guy, he's just like, yeah, Jesus just is like, if I don't need to take the heat for this one and I can slough it off to a pizza guy, why wouldn't I do that? So, Indiana, under incredible pressure, particularly from the business community, I think, in Indiana, and also from the fantasy world where every Hoosier is a great person. And we weren't the home of the revival of the KKK in the 1920s and on and on and on. You got to maintain. Indiana is particularly nice as opposed to any other state in the country. It's just a coincidence that they would do this. And can you imagine the absolute shock all of these anti-gay bigots felt when they realized that this legislation seems to discriminate against gay people? So they took all of this shock and channeled it into a legislative fix, and I say that in quotations, of their version of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, so that it was more akin to the federal version. Now, one of the fixes is, and the reason why Indiana did this in part, was some cities in Indiana actually are part of the 21st century. And so some cities and counties had passed laws that said you cannot discriminate against a person if they are gay. In other words, if they come to your restaurant, you have to feed them, just like you would any other customer, as if they were like a normal person. If you have a hotel, you actually have to allow them to pay you money and have lodging in your hotel. So the state law no longer supersedes the state and county law. I mean, the city or county laws. There's not a lot of them, I think, but there's some indication that there is some modernity in Indiana. There are some good Hoosiers still. This fix does nothing about the Hobby Lobby dilemma. The Hobby Lobby decision on this from the Supreme Court was the first time that RFRA was taken to mean that not just, and remember, the federal RFRA was set up because two Native Americans, I believe, who were had something to do with their employment. They had taken some form, I think it was peyote or something like that, as part of their religious ceremony, and I think a drug test kept them from getting hired or something to that effect. Hobby Lobby goes further than that because it says that your religious rights, I mean, putting aside the whole closely owned corporation and that type of thing, your religious rights can actually trump the rights of other people. So whereas RFRA was supposed to set up this notion and define that, like, your rights end where my nose begins, saying, you know, defining the definition of the nose in that instance. In this case, Hobby Lobby basically says, actually, your rights can extend somewhere into my nose because my fist, if it's a religious one, has a little bit extra sort of space to go forward. And if it dents in your nose, it dents in your nose. And the other thing that has got to be really clear, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people have no new rights, no special rights. They're not a protected class of people in Indiana, despite the fact that they obviously need to be. So the Indiana RFRA fix now brings Indiana from openly hostile and discriminatory to just implicitly hostile and discriminatory.
towards people and justified in the name of their religion. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, I'm going to be putting up those new perks on the Indiegogo campaign and I guess formulating what is the stretch goal. I mean, it's pretty obvious in my mind. We're going to have a nicer set. We're going to have some other features on the program that we've always wanted, maybe transcribing some things, you know, like interviews like that maybe in the future. But we will work that up. In the meantime, if you want to become a member of the program, head over to majority.fm or join the majoritireport.com. You can also support this program by becoming a by purchasing your coffee at justcoffee.co-op, fair trade coffee, tea or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, and in the month of April, no shipping costs. This is the best time to try that out. If you have ever wondered, should I try this out? Would I like the coffee? Now's the time. Would I save some cash? Now is the time. Try out the coffee. Do it early in the month so that when you want to reorder, you'll still have this month worth of free shipping, because I guess they're doing some rebranding on their packaging, and that's why they're doing it. Also, if you buy your crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majoritireportkickback.com. Majoritireportkickback.com. Click on the link, bookmark it. You will notice no difference, but we will get a kickback. Something wrong with this chair. That's one of the things I like to do, buy a new chair. This chair is hurting me now. I'm not exactly sure what's going on. Maybe a stretch. Stretch goal. Sam gets a chair that is actually comfortable. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IMS through the app. Don't have the other email. I mean, IM things. Can't figure out how to get those working here for some reason. So, 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back after this.